Now, Captain James King, Royal Navy, fellow of the Royal Society, James King came from a Malmdale family, a well-established Malmdale family, but he was actually born and went to school in Clitheroe before he joined the Navy and ultimately sailed with Captain Cook on Captain Cook's third voyage. Anyway, in the talk, I want first to look at James's antecedents, in particularly those here in Malmdale, and how those family connections may have affected James's choice of career and the progress that he made of it in a time when who you knew and what family you belonged to probably mattered much more than your ability and what you were able to do. And then I'll talk a little bit about his early life before having a bit about the Bible before having a whistle-stop tour through his career, covering there was a period before he went with Captain Cook, the voyage itself, which I could spend a whole evening on, and then the time that he spent after that voyage, spent mainly writing up the account of the part of the voyage after Cook was killed. So, the King family. According to tradition, the first member of the King family to come into Malmdale was Robert King, and he's recorded as being vicar of Kirby Malham between 1585 and 1602. So at that point I'm going to sidetrack and talk a bit about the King Bible. So that's the family of Malmdale, the King Bible. When I first heard about the King Bible in Malmdale, I assumed it was King James Bible, but it's only called the King Bible because it belonged to the King family. It's a 1572 second folio of the Bishop's Bible, which was first printed, I think, in 1568. And this Bible has got a very interesting story. Maybe you thought that, as perhaps I had in the back of my mind, that the King James Bible was the first Bible in English, but of course it wasn't by any means. I mean, Bede, before his death, was busy translating St. John's Gospel. There were a lot of earlier translations into Old English. Then we had, in 1384, the Wycliffe Bible, but that was simply a translation into English of the Latin word for word, and it didn't go back to any of the original text. So had certain limitations. Then we had various others, the Tyndale Bible. Then we came to the Great Bible, which was produced by license under in Henry VIII's reign by a guy called Miles Coverdale. And this was sort of the standard Bible of the time. But following Henry VIII's death, when Mary Tudor came to the throne, things were not very good for the Protestant Bible translators and people who wanted to reform, and a lot of them went off to Geneva, where there was quite a collection of translators. John Knox was there at that time, Calvin was there at that time, and a lot of translations of the Bible were made, not only into English, but many were into English, and they were published initially out in Switzerland, and then subsequently they were printed in the UK. And for example, the Bibles that were issued by Oliver Cromwell in the Civil War to the soldiers were based on that Geneva Bible. And when that got into common use, it was realised what the deficiencies were of the Great Bible. And there had been a proposal in Henry VIII's time by the Archbishop of Canterbury that a new translation, official translation, should be made. And that went into abeyance during Mary Tudor's reign. But 3 years into Elizabeth's reign, Archbishop Parker, he proposed that a committee of bishops should be got together to do an official translation. One of the problems with the Geneva Bible was not so much the translation, but the annotations and the comments that were made, some of which were very Calvinistic in tone and didn't suit the fashion of the day. Incidentally, a lot of these earlier translators had been accused of heresy, they'd been burned. Tyndale, I think, years after his death, was dug up and his body burned and thrown into the river on the orders of the Pope. So they had a rough time of it. So, anyway, in 1561, Archbishop Parker proposes that a new translation shall be made, and he gets a committee of bishops together, and these are approved by Elizabeth, and they produce what becomes known as the Bishop's Bible. And this is one copy of it. And I can do no better, I think, now than to read a little bit that was written when this Bible came into the parish of Kirkby Malham in about 1985. And I found this among the church archives, and I think it must have been written by Charles Trevor, who was the vicar at the time. And he said, "Last year our church received a most interesting and welcome gift from a Mr. Alan Hume of Chester. Mr. Hume is a dealer in antique maps and prints, and a few years ago he discovered in a bookshop a much battered folio-sized volume, which proved to be an old Bible. It was in very poor condition, the front and back board suffering from extensive worming, as you can see, the first dozen or so pages missing, including the title page, and a further 40 or 50 badly curled and foxed. Contained many woodcut biblical scenes and small maps. But what attracted Mr. Hume was a very fine map of the Holy Land attached to the spine by a piece of paper. And he purchased the volume, and on making a closer inspection he found that it had a fascinating history. His research showed that it was one of the few remaining examples of a second edition of the Bishop's Bible, published in 1572. And this was borne out by an inscription on the small cartouche decorating the Holy Land map, which said, "Graven by Humphrey Cole Goldsmith, an Englishman, born in Ye North and pertaining to Ye Mint in the Tower, 1572. On several of the originally blank pages, sort of, or half pages at the end of a Gospel or the end of a book of the Old Testament, various hands had penned details of the ownership, and they recorded names, baptisms, occupations, deaths, and it recorded that the first purchaser was none other than Robert King of Skellons, Kirkby Malham, who purchased it in 1572. And thereafter, there were a series of entries which made it possible to trace the ownership of the Bible right down to 1846, after which there weren't any further entries, and it was then owned by Mary Armstrong, who was descended from the Kings and was living in Liverpool. However, one particularly interesting detail was on the back of the Holy Land map, recording that Henry King, who was the son of Robert, being loyal to king and country, put the Bible together with other valuables into an iron chest and buried it during the time of Oliver Cromwell. And a second note refers to a great rebellion in 1740. Well, I presume it was coming up to Jacobite 1745, but it did say 1740, when the Bible and a sum of money were hidden in a well for a considerable period of time. Now, you can see it does show its history. Yes. You can imagine that's where it's been. Mr. Hume retained the map because that's what he wanted it for. He was a map collector. And he thought it was fitting that it should be returned to Kirkby Malham, where its history began. And since then, it's lived in the vicarage, it's lived in David Tippy's workshop, and after David died, and Mike and I were clearing stuff out of David's office and workshop, and I collected together all the church archive stuff, it came to, well, it came to light. It saw the light of day again. And the PCC have entrusted it to my care as the person to sort of keep nominal care of the church archive. And in fact, we took it to the North Yorkshire Records office yesterday to get some advice on how it should be treated. So that's the King Bible. So I've just photographed a few bits out of it. They're very difficult to read. This is Mary Armstrong writing in 1845. And it says, you won't be able to read that, but it says, "Mary Armstrong's book, 1845, printed in 1572, in the King family 243 years, was 243 years old in 1845, surprisingly. Mary Armstrong's mother named before marriage Mary King, the oldest daughter of Richard King." And these are just some examples of other pages. Would it be better if I had the lights off? Would you be able to see better? The switch is just outside. Yeah. Just outside the door. Yeah. That's probably better, isn't it? You won't be able to read it, but you can get an essence of it. And with Billy Baker's permission, I've brought it along this evening, so at the end of the talk you're welcome to have a look. Don't treat it very gently. Clean hands are quite acceptable these days to handle paper. We don't wear wet cotton gloves because the sensitivity of them tends to do more damage to the paper than clean hands. So and I've marked the pages that are interesting, and if you do want to look, I suggest you just look at that one and this one near the back that I've also marked. So this is a couple of pages that have got rather more detail on them than most. And if you look at that little bit at the top in greater detail, it says we've got two contrasting entries, one above the other, one in the brown ink and one in the blue ink. Top one says, Henry King, son of Robert King, born 4th April in the year of our Lord God, 1638, at Kirby Mallardale, Yorkshire. And then underneath it says, Mary Armstrong left this book to Alice Margaret Armstrong, her daughter, 1846, because Alice King wished it. So, I think it's a fascinating thing. It says, what we do with it quite is another question. So,
that's scribbled out there.
It's very difficult to see. We can have a look at it more carefully. I've been trying to work out what he did, but it does say,
I think it's son of Henry King.
Henry. And I think it's Robert King, son of Henry King, as far as I can make out. And then there's something in the blue ink of Mary's there. So, I could spend hours going through trying to sort the genealogy out, but some of it's already been done and we've got copies of that. So, the family tree.
Robin, I can fill you in a bit on Robert King. He was actually here in 1572.
Was he as early as that? Yeah. Well, certainly the records are. I mean, some things they believe to be here, but I'm quite confident he was here, wasn't he? Yeah, thank you. Right, so 1572 to 1602. Thomas King, who was our James down here, James King, Captain James King's great-great-great-grandfather, he built Church End in Kirby Malham in 1672, which is now the vicarage. And he is said to have garrisoned the Kirby Malham Church for the Parliamentary forces during the Civil War. Again, you get a bit mixed up because there's several Thomases, and then on this side, we've got, according to Whittaker's genealogy, we've got a Henry King here, and it's his great great grandson sailed with Lord Anson in his circumnavigation of the globe in about 1740. Who we think might have influenced our James King to go into the Navy. However, our friend Morkill says that the family lineage is that this guy was actually Robert. And looking at some of the entries in the Bible, that seems to add up more that he was Robert. But I don't know. It's very difficult to be sure after all these years. So, so that's the house, as we know, that he built. And the family lived at Skellons. Of course, this is the 19th century house. And whether that was on that site or whether it was King House in Scostrop, which is on the Skellons site, which is probably recorded as to where James's father was born, I don't know. And of course, we'll all be familiar, in Kirby Malham Church, there's a north window commemorating the kings of Skellons, supposedly living there from 1424 to 1824. So whether they were here as early as that, because most of the things you read say that that Robert came into Malhamdale from Westmorland. But perhaps you're able to tell me more about that. Yeah. So anyway, the kings were then at Skellons for several generations. Our James's father, who's also a James, was born in Malhamdale in 1716. Now, whether he attended the church at Kirby Malham, the Free Grammar School, I've no idea, and I've not seen any record of it. But after that, he went. He did go to St John's College, Cambridge, and became then his first position was the minister of St Mary's Church in Clitheroe. And this is the Victorianised version of it because it didn't look like that at the time. And this James actually He was a high flyer because he went on to be the Vicar of Guildford, he went on to be the Canon of Windsor, he was chaplain to the House of Commons, and he finished up as a dean in Ireland before moving back to die in Woodstock, where one of his other sons was a rector. So we go back to the family tree for the moment. We're down here. This is the James, born in at Skellens, again Vicar of Clitheroe Downham, and he had at least 9 children. There was Anne, Lettice, Mariana, Edmund, and so on. But the ones who feature most in history are these. The eldest one, Thomas, he can be Rector of Bladen and Woodstock and the Chancellor of Lincoln and Prebendary of Canterbury. The second one was our James. The third, Walker, became Bishop of Rochester. The fourth son was Vice Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. And the youngest one, John, became Secretary of State in 2 of the governments of the time. So they achieved great distinction, didn't they, 2 of them. I've mentioned that James would have no doubt heard of his distant cousin who sailed with Anson in circumnavigating the globe, and this might have inspired him, but there were also a lot of other family connections which might have had an influence. I took this from some King papers in Clitheroe Reference Library, who were very helpful to me in providing a lot of papers, and James's grandmother was Alice Sargentson. Thomas King, our James's father, had married Alice. She was the son of the daughter of William Sargentson and Jane Walker. And through the line of Elizabeth Sargentson, they married into the Nortons. And Sir Fletcher Norton was the Speaker of the House of Commons, and later became Lord Grantley, and he had a lot of influence in the Navy at the time. There was a little note on this piece of paper that said, "Norton, a shrewd, unprincipled man of good abilities and offensive manners." Anyway, he had a sibling, William, and he's the one who went to sea. So the Sargentsons, as most of us know, had been in Mallandale since at least the 14th century and built Hamlet Hall in the 1600s, and they were here until the 20th century. Fletcher was also known, he was a lawyer as well as everything else, and he was known as Sir Bullfaced Double Fee. So, his early life. As I say, our James was born in Clitheroe in 1750, baptised on the 13th of July that year. And the family lived in a house, if any of you know Clitheroe, on the site of what is now the Yorkshire Bank. Of course, it didn't look like that at the time, but there is a blue plaque there on the wall, which you can find, which commemorates Captain James King. You probably walked past it many times and not realised it was there. At the time, the house would have looked like this. They lived in it before it came the Brownlow Arms. It became a pub later, but that was the house where our James was born in Clitheroe. His brothers went to Sedbergh School. They're recorded at Sedbergh. But he attended Clitheroe Grammar School, which was just a few hundred yards from his home. And that would have been the building that he attended, not the one that we see now on the main road you're going into to Clitheroe, or the one on the roundabout there. This was the original building. There aren't any registers in existence from that time, but there is a written record of a recitation read at the school commemoration day of 1786, just 2 years after our James had died, and it was written by the then headmaster, and it included the lines, "As Captain King here joined the jovial crew, and on the spot his first instruction grew," which I think confirms that he was there. So, local tradition has it that he would have climbed Pendle Hill, and from the top of Pendle Hill seen the Irish Sea over beyond the Fylde coast and beyond Preslin, and it would have been that led him to want to go to sea. But whatever the reason, he joined the Navy on the 19th of November 1762, and he was barely 12 years old at the time. This was the same year that Cook, who was to be his companion later, he was just getting married. And he was 22 years younger than Captain Cook, but he was only 7 years behind him in naval service, because Cook didn't enter the Navy until he was relatively old. But as we saw, James had an entree into the service through his father's cousin, Captain William Norton. And I've just come back to this to remind you. He was here in... Oh, I've not put him in on that one. Anyway, he came in as the brother of Sir Fletcher Norton. So his first ship was... this was his second ship, the HMS Duke Guernsey, but it was one rather like this. And he went to serve on an African Guard ship under William Norton, who was a captain in the Navy by that time. And he was described as an able seaman or a midshipman or a junior officer. But it seemed, because of his connections, he was treated very much like a junior officer. And over the next 4 years, he served in various ships, going the age of 12, 13, 14, And he finished up in 1768 on this vessel, HMS Guernsey, under Captain James Chads. And at that point, they go to Newfoundland. And he served on the Newfoundland station. Well, any of you who know much about Captain Cook, he was in Newfoundland at the time. He was surveying all the Newfoundland coast and the area around there, and it's quite likely that James would have certainly known of Captain Cook. Whether he actually came into contact with him, there's no record. And then within a year, he was back in the Mediterranean, and he was promoted to the, he passed to the rank of lieutenant by 1769. But he didn't actually get promoted to a position of this rank until a couple of years later. Now, in 1763, the 7 Years' War had ended with the Treaty of Paris. And 10 years on from this, the government were getting the idea that, well, things were more peaceful, they didn't need to spend as much money on the Navy, and a lot of naval office were laid off on half pay, or as it was said, they were put on the beach. And they had to survive on half pay, and if trouble flared up, then they were recalled. And James was one of these, but he took the opportunity to get permission to travel to Paris, and we'd recently been at war with France. We always seem to be at war with France, didn't we? And he went there to study science, and presumably the French language as well. And then he returned to England, and he went to Oxford, and he spent time at Corpus Christi College. And one of his brothers was there, and he wasn't actually a member of the college, but he mixed with the academics. And in particular, he became acquainted by a guy called the Reverend Thomas Hornsby, who was the civilian professor of astronomy at Oxford. And he must have impressed Hornsby, because when it came to choosing people to go with Cook on his third voyage, Hornsby was the person who recommended our James to go. So we then come to Cook's third voyage on HMS Resolution. Now, King's recommendation from Hornsby was a great bonus for Captain Cook. First, he didn't like having non-naval men on his boats, and the alternative was to have an astronomer or with him who wasn't a naval officer. And it meant that as a naval officer, he was competent to take charge of a ship's watch, but he could also do all the astronomical calculations that were necessary. So he saved him a man, effectively, by going. And he was offered the position by the Board of Admiralty and the Board of Longitude as second lieutenant or navigating officer. So by this time, he's only 26. He's got 14 years of naval service behind him, although three of them had been on leave studying science. And Cook's biographer, writing about King, describes King as the best educated, best read and most intellectual officer in Resolution and Discovery. Discovery, the other boat, the other ship, I'm never sure whether I get the other craft, let's say. He also gave an unattributed quote which said, King was a gentle, fastidious, hypochondriacal and kindly man who might be regarded as effeminate by the ruder members of Resolution's company, of which there were many, but who was to be a great solace and close companion to Cook during the difficult months ahead. In command of Discovery with the Resolution was a guy called Charles Clark, who had been with Cook on his first voyage and first two voyages, and who Cook wanted with him. Now, the expedition was supposed to have left in April 1776, because they wanted to get into the Pacific and up to the Barents Strait by June the following year to take advantage of the Arctic summer. But it got into the middle of the year before they got away, and King wrote in his journal then, "It was on this exact day 4 years ago that Captain Cook sailed in this ship from Plymouth on the expedition in search of a southern continent. The singularity of the circumstances make us look upon this as an omen of like prosperous voyage." What a mistake he made in making that statement. Because in the end, as I say, Discovery didn't get away until the end of the month. And it had orders from Cook to follow them in Resolution to the Cape of Good Hope with all speed. And the reason was that Charles Clark, the captain of the other ship, was in prison, in the debtor's prison in St. George's Fields, London. He was there because he'd guaranteed some debts for his brother. His brother had gone off to the West Indies and left all his debts, so poor old Clark was thrown into prison. But that did have quite a serious consequence later, because it's believed that while he was in prison there he contacted tuberculosis, which was to be significant later in the voyage. So they were very late departing. In spite of the extra time they had to repair, the boat was in a bad state. Rain and sea water came through the hull into the officers' cabins. But the ship's company were no doubt buoyed up by the thought that they might finish up with a share of the 20,000 prize for negotiating the Northwest Passage. Because, of course, the main point of Cook's third voyage was to go around and try and find the route between Europe and China, or Cathay, coming from the Pacific end through to the Atlantic. Most of the other expeditions were going the other way, and there was a prize of £20,000 offered for the ones that got through first. In fact, if you were going from this side, the prize was staged according to how far, what longitude you got to. I don't know whether it was if you were coming back the other way. But that was the whole idea. Plus, they had to do astronomical observations and to check out and try out various new ideas on nautical astronavigation, which had been developed by the Astronomer Royal, a guy called Maskelyne. And although Harrison, of course, had developed his clocks by that time, which should have been allowed them to calculate longitude, they were not trusted even then. They certainly within the Admiralty and within the Astronomer Royal. When Harrison's clocks went across the Atlantic and were checked when they got to the West Indies or whatever, and they were found to be within 39 seconds or what, it was put down to luck. As a result, Harrison didn't get his money until many years later. So the calculations required to calculate longitude were long and laborious. I mean, to do it without slide rule calculator by long calculation took hours to try and do this. So they were trying to check the accuracy of these chronometers. So they had a lot of repairs to do. They were carrying animals. George III had this idea. It was called George's Farm, King George's Farm. They had enough animals on that they were going to take through to Tahiti and set up farms there for the benefit of the natives, because George III had heard from Cook's second voyage that the natives were very poor there. And they had to stop at places like Madeira and so on to find fodder for the animals. They got horses, they got cattle, they got pigs, they got all sorts. It was absolute pantomime, to be honest. Yeah. Anyway, and this put them further behind. So by the time they got round the South Pacific, it was clear they wouldn't get to the Arctic that summer. So let's have a look at the map. This is where they were to go. We're coming here on the red line to start with, down round the Cape of Good Hope, down to Van Diemen's Land, as Tasmania was known there, through New Zealand, and then they were to work their way north up and go through the gap between Asia and North America and try and find a way through these islands to the north of Canada and down south of Greenland and back to the UK. So it was too late for them to get up here, so they spent time exploring the islands of the Pacific, which Cook, of course, had been to twice before. So by the beginning of 1777, they were in Van Diemen's Land in Tasmania, and then they made this circuit of the islands here. And this is a more detailed map for 1777-1778. So they would go through between the two islands of New Zealand, circle around the Friendly Islands and Tahiti, and then up past Christmas Island into the Hawaiian Islands here. So it was this is a drawing of what resolution would have looked like there in these Pacific Islands, with the Polynesians with their outrigger canoes coming, trying to exchange food and sell them things and so on. So then, at the beginning of 1778, they head off north to try to get up here through this little strait up here. And they eventually they went over the American coast and followed the coast up, trying to find an inlet that might let them through. And eventually they went through the Bering Strait. And they got to 70 degrees 44 north, which is a long way north, but they ran into pack ice. As you may know, in the Arctic, there could be good ice years, bad ice years. This was a pretty bad ice year. They didn't get terribly far north. And they were forced back by the pack ice, and they went down here to Hawaii for the winter. They were going to spend another winter. It's amazing the length of time these people spent away from home. And here they were in Hawaii. And the Hawaiians, they looked upon Cook, he'd been there before, and they looked upon him as a personification of their god Lono, and he was given the name Orono by the Hawaiians. Now, James King, they regarded as being Cook's son, and also, therefore, a deity in their eyes. And when the expedition was due to depart again in February the next year, the Hawaiians wanted Cook to leave King there as a sort of token, because, you know, he was what their god, he should stay. And King wasn't having any of that, although Cook said he would think about it. Anyway, eventually they sailed, and of course King went with them. But 2 days later, they ran into a severe storm, and there was a ferocious gust, and it split the mast of Resolution, and Cook had no alternative but to take them back into Hawaii for repairs. And when they got back, after having relatively friendly relations with the natives there, things had changed. There was a completely different atmosphere, and there was a lot of pilfering, pinching of stuff, and this was dealt with quite severely. And then the crunch came when the cutter from one of the boats was stolen. And Cook decided that he should go into the village, and either by deception or by force, he was going to kidnap the king of the tribe in Hawaii, take him back to Discovery and hold him as a hostage until they got this cutter back. However, when James King was trying to dissuade him of this and trying to keep things calmed down, apparently he and Clark were very much for keeping things on a sort of more level basis. And but Cook was ordered King to keep out of it, and he said, "Your business, Mr. King, is to quiet the minds of the Indians on your side of the bay and inform them that they won't be hurt." And King managed to keep the situation on his side of the bay relatively quiet, but Cook's party ran into trouble. They were attacked. A number of Cook's marines were killed, a number of natives were killed, and Cook himself was killed. And Cook's body was chopped into pieces and distributed around the island. I don't know whether they were regarded as relics because he was a deity or for what reason, but that's what happened. And James King was regarded by the natives as the new Orono. He was the new king, the new deity, as it were, the new king or god or whatever, you know. And after a while, King Cook body they wanted to get back, and our James King went and negotiated with the high priest, and eventually he and Clark went, and they got a parcel of Cook's remains, which included the hands, the skull, the scalp, the lower legs and the feet, and they gave these a burial at sea. So that was the end of Captain Cook. Now after that, Clark became, he was the more senior officer, he took charge of discovery, and a guy called John Gore was in Resolution, and John Gore took over Discovery. But Clark, as we found, I said earlier, had got TB from his time in the debtor's prison, and he was spending a lot of time in his cabin. But the expedition's orders were that if they hadn't found an entrance to the Northwest Passage in the first summer, they had to try in the second summer. So after they the boat was completely repaired, they set off again. And after 6 weeks of miserable sailing through fog and mist, they managed to get as far as Kamchatka on the coast here. And this is a part under there. There was a village called Bolsheretsk. And this was a contemporary drawing of that village made by Weber, who was the official artist on the expedition. Here, our Captain King met a guy called Baim, who was the Russian governor of the province there, and he undertook to send the news of Cook's death overland to England. Now, in the middle of the 1700s, I don't suppose he wrote a letter and put a stamp on it, but 11 months later, the news travelled from right across Asia and finished up at the Admiralty in London with the news of Cook's death. So before the expedition got back, at least they knew what had happened to him. So they set off again, going north. They eventually passed through the St. Diomede Islands. Now these are a group of islands in the middle of the Bering Strait where you can see both North America and Asia. And they went through there, and they struggled to find a way through the ice. It was an even worse ice year, I think, this year. And when Discovery was caught in the ice and damaged, they had no option but to go back down to the western coast, the eastern coast of Asia, and do repairs. At that time, Clark's tuberculosis overtook him, and he sadly died. So John Gore took over command of Resolution, and our Captain King then took command of the other vessel, Discovery. And while in Kamchatka, they were doing things like hunting polar bears, and King shot a polar bear. A bit of time to spare, the Russians took them off hunting. And then they decided that the Northwest Passage wasn't going to be possible that year, they should set off. And they went down the coast of Japan, charting as they went. They arrived in China in December, where there was a message from the Admiralty to say all the journals and records of the voyage were to be given to our James King. And even the crew had to give up their own personal journals, which King told them he would seal up and until he had instructions from the Lords of the Admiralty as to what to do with them regarding publishing the story of the voyage. And it was another year before they got back to the UK via Cape Town, and oddly they anchored in Stromness in Orkney. I don't know why they went that way and then down the North Sea. I don't know whether it was because I don't know who we were at war with at the time. I think it'd be the Dutch, the Spanish and the French, and it was probably not safe to come up the channel. Anyway, King left the vessels in Stromness and he travelled over to the north of Sutherland and came down to Scotland and came back to London overland. So, after Cook, on his return to London, King was now appointed post-captain. He was given the account of writing up the account of the voyages from the point of Cook's death through to the return to England. Obviously, Cook's own journals covered it up to that point, and a guy called the Reverend Dr. John Douglas was given the job of going through Cook's own journals and writing up that. So, Cook was back in London. No doubt he would have gone over to Ireland where his parents were, his father was the Dean of Raphoe at the time. But he was apparently in great demand in London society. A young woman called Fanny Burney, who was the sister of one of the other officers on the boat and who was described as one of the bright young things of London society at the time, wrote in her diaries, "We went to see Mr. Webbers to see his South Sea drawings. Here we met Captain King, who chiefly did the honours in showing us his curiosities and explaining them. He is one of the most natural, gay, honest and pleasant characters I have ever met with." So he seemed to charm the people that he met, did R. James. He was very popular. Anyway, after 6 months of leave and working on the account, he was given the command of a vessel of his own called HMS Crocodile, which was a newly built man of war, and they sailed out of Portsmouth to Spithead in 1781, and there King had to read the articles of war to the ship's company. England was at war, as it usually was, on several fronts. The War of American Independence had begun in 1776. We'd been at war with France once again since 1778. We'd been at war with Spain since 1779. And we'd been at war with the Dutch since 1779. So he then spent about a year cruising up and down the Channel from the southwest of Ireland to the Channel Islands with periods of prolonged boredom interspersed with periods of violent action. And they were stopping and searching any ships that they could come across. And the main prizes were to try and find privateers who were coming back from the West Indies. And they picked some of these off, and it was rich pickings. Some of these ships had been captured and recaptured and changed hands several times before they got to the point where King's crew took control of them. And then he got a bigger ship, and finally a ship that was given convoy duties to escort a convoy bound for the West Indies. And this convoy of 31 ships he managed to deliver to the West Indies without a single loss, which was quite remarkable. And this is a portrait by Webber, the artist who went on the expedition, and it was said that the stress of commanding the convoy had turned King's hair grey, and certainly by the time we get to this portrait of him in 1782, when he would have been, 30 years, yeah. He certainly lost a lot of hair and is quite grey. So he then spent 18 months out in the West Indies, principally hunting the French in the waters around the West Indies. And during this time he made contact with Horatio Nelson. Nelson had wrote in one of his reports, "On Thursday the 6th instant, a few leagues to windward of Monte Cristi, I fell in with His Majesty's ship Resistance under Captain King. And from him I received information that the French had taken Turks Island." So Nelson decides to take King with him and another ship that he managed to get, and they're going to recapture Turks Island. Anyway, in the end, they attacked the island. They found it much better defended than they thought it would be, and the better part of valour led them to withdraw. So for one action at least, our James King was under the command of Horatio Nelson. Anyway, by June of 1783, he has to sign off the vessel and return to England with ill health. And by this time, he'd only another 16 months to live. When he got back to London, the reports seemed to suggest he didn't have a house of his own. Well, probably not, because he'd been sailing the high seas for so long. But his younger brother, Walker King, was a great friend of Edmund Burke, the statesman, and his family. And it seemed that the Burkes were very hospitable to our James, as many of the letters that he wrote at that time are addressed from Burke's house in Beaconsfield or in London. And he now sets to seriously to continue with the work on the account of the voyage. This is, what, now 2.5, 3 years after they got back, so he's still working on it. But his health's obviously not good, because immediately after his arrival back from Jamaica, he writes to Dr. Douglas, who's doing the rest of the account, amongst other things in the letter it says, "I was obliged to leave my ship on account of my health, which, however better, is not yet re-established, an ugly cough and hoarseness still plaguing me." So you can guess what he was suffering from. But he has his better periods, and in October he writes again to Dr. Douglas and says, "I was foolish enough to dance 2 nights ago at Blenheim, by which I got a cold, on which account my friends think I had better not set off as intended for Windsor tomorrow to see you, but you can depend on seeing me on Wednesday." And he's obviously getting help from his brother with the writing, because he's finding it difficult, and he says later in the letter, "I got copied fair for the last time, the first 3 chapters, and Walker will soon have from the 4th to the 10th in order, and I have got in great forwardness the 11th and 12th. It says, I hope, at last convinced Walker of the same urgency, whose assistance is now becoming absolutely necessary, as writing disagrees with me very much." But in December, he's well enough to attend a royal court, because he writes again that I kissed the King's hand last Wednesday, and the Queen's on Thursday, and when I meet you, I will communicate you all that passed between us. So he's still in the society world. They had some interesting correspondence. One of the points was that they had a great discussion about whether the natives of the Sandwich Islands, when they sang in unison or sang in parts. And Dr. Burney, who was the father of Fanny Burney, who I mentioned earlier, he was a well-known musician and organist at Chelsea Hospital, and his opinion was sought as to whether the Sandwich Islands were likely to sing in 4 parts or 3 parts or whatever. Anyway, the work that Cook had done during the voyage hadn't gone unacknowledged. For his astronomical observations, together with those of Cook and William Bailey, who was also on there, these were published by order of the Commissioner's Longitude, and for this work he was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. He was also made an honorary Doctor of Laws at Oxford University. Not bad for a young man who'd left school at 12, had a few years at Clitheroe Grammar School, studied on his own in Paris, and obviously, well, self-taught, and yet he must have been quite some mathematician if he'd been able to do all this, these astronomical computations and write up a scientific report on them. Eventually, in the summer of 1784, the 3-volume account of Cook's third voyage, of which King's work formed the 3rd volume, was published. This was the frontispiece of the account, and it says, A voyage to the Pacific Ocean, undertaken by the command of His Majesty for making discoveries in the Northern Hemisphere, performed under direction of Captain Cook, Clark and Gore, in 3 volumes, 1 and 2, written by James Cook, volume 3 by Captain James King. So he had his place in history, and those are the 3 volumes, quite a nice looking book. Anyway, having completed this, his health was deteriorating further, and he travelled from England to Nice with 2 friends, James Trevenan, who'd been with him on both the Resolution and Discovery, and a Captain William Young, who'd served with him on the Guernsey years before. And he died in November 1784 from the tuberculosis, which was obviously got a at the age of only 34 years. And he was buried in Nice, so he wasn't brought back to the UK. And Edmund Burke wrote in a letter to a friend saying, "In truth, James King was made and singularly framed to inspire confidence and attachment. His temper was admirable. He reconciled to him the people wherever he went. There was hardly an island visited by Cook in which the natives did not press him to remain with them." So, anyway, a memorial was erected in the church in Clitheroe, St Mary Magdalene Church in Clitheroe. But in the Victorian restoration that was done when we saw with the spire, that obviously Victorian worked the church now, this memorial was either lost or destroyed, sadly. But there is a memorial to him at Woodstock, where his father was and his brother was the rector. And it's a memorial to James King, his father, the Dean of Raphoe, but on the bottom of that, the brothers put also to the memory of their beloved brother, Captain James King in the Royal Navy, LLD FRS, friend and colleague of Captain Cook in his last voyage round the world, history of which from the time of the death of that celebrating navigator he wrote at Woodstock during the short intervals of his retirement from the public service of his country, in which his laborious and most uninterrupted exertion brought on a premature and deeply lamented death. He died in the 32nd year of his age, 1784, at Nice, where he is interred. Unfortunately, it wasn't the 32nd year of his age, it was the 34th. His brothers either couldn't calculate or the stonemason got it wrong. But there is a similar plaque in Clitheroe Royal Grammar School which gets it right. Sometimes scholar of this school and friend and colleague of Captain Cook. He died in the year 1784, aged 34. Now, James also has two islands named after him, I'm told, in the things I've read. One in the Bering Sea, close to the coast of Alaska, which was named after him by Captain Cook, and one off the west coast of North America, named after him by Captain Vancouver. But I've searched Google Maps, atlases, I can't find them. So I don't think they were very big. So, anyway, that is Captain James King.